So welcome to the podcast for Kingdom Now, Mook, and thank you for sharing with us a little bit today. I appreciate you putting in, because I know this stuff is helpful for people.
Yeah.
I know talking to other people about stuff that happens to me is super helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, just if you want to maybe share a little bit about your experience, you know, you've been come out in a sense of a group that's very fundamentalist and very strict, and there's been a lot of dramas around it. You want to just give us a bit of background on how you were brought up and sort of where, you know, how your family is operated, maybe, just to start?
Yeah, well, I was brought into a fundamentalist family, so it was all I'd ever known my entire life, until I was about 15 or 16, and then that's when I started to see that there was other things out there. But before that, my entire life, I thought that the way that things were done in our home and the way my dad would run his ministry, like, that was the only way. There was no other way.
Because that's all you'd known, I suppose. You're insular in that sense. Where were you brought up? Where was...
In Papua New Guinea. Okay. My dad was a missionary there. I was born there, so I lived there basically my whole life until I was 15. That was... Our whole life was just ministry. I started teaching Sunday school when I was 12 and running the youth groups and the choirs and just church. Church was everything all the time. But it was more for me anyway, my personal experience. It was more of keeping things going and running things smoothly and making people happy rather than having an awareness of God. And... Yeah, that's I don't know. I was very inserted into everything and I loved it. I loved the church. I loved the ministries. I loved what my dad was doing, but it was more for me. It was because that's what you do.
Yeah, because you were born into it. That's all you'd ever known was the family, and I guess you'd seen. So you've got how many sisters and brothers have you got?
One brother and three sisters.
Okay, and they'd all
older.
And
I was the youngest, I was the youngest, so I would follow in their footsteps.
Yes.
And then when they all started leaving home, that's when I had to step up and I had a lot more responsibility. And I was quite young. I was like 12 to 15 at this stage when they started leaving home.
So that would have been significant then. So they were sort of, they'd shown the way, and then all of a sudden they're sort of heading off, and now what, were you left sort of holding some stuff?
Yep, and my dad had to leave as well because he was really sick because he has Lyme disease. So he decided to leave when I think it was the start of 2015. So it was just me and my mum there, and all my siblings had left home at that point. And that's when I really had to step up, and that's when I took over, like, the choir and, like, fully running half the church almost.
It was a big responsibility for a young one.
A lot of church and a lot of doing and not really being aware of, like, God in me. And, yeah, I didn't, like, I wasn't really a deep thinker back then about a lot of things. I just sort of was happy with how everything was.
So you were enjoying what you were doing?
Yeah, I was really happy. And I was very Papua New Guinean in my way of living, so I was very satisfied with my little life over there.
Because that's significant. So talk a little bit about that maybe, when you say very Papua New Guinean, and is that like a village lifestyle then?
Yeah, very community sort of focused living. Like, we had a property that was surrounded by four different villages.
Okay.
And my whole day was just interacting with a lot of other people. Like, I would get up in the morning, I'd just wander over and go, like, eat some food with people and just hang out with them, and then go help my mum do stuff and plan activities with people, and then all afternoon you just go, like, sit on the grass and talk to people, play basketball. There was just, like, no stress, really. It was quite a chilled out.
Because no one's going off to work as such.
No one works. Their working is gardening, so I just go hang out with them in the garden.
And that's there too.
I don't know, it was just a very relaxed, laid back, chilled out kind of experience.
Yeah, so a pretty good way to grow up in a way, really, because you mentioned, like, a lot of people said that it's quite scary up there and there's a lot of dramas and fighting and all that, but you told me that you weren't really that scared at all growing up.
No, not growing up. No, I wasn't. I was always very relaxed in my life there. And then I had, like, that traumatising situation when I was 12 where we had... a few people run into our house to, like, seek refuge from, like, people that were trying to kill them.
Oh, that's right. This is a tribal war scenario?
Yeah.
Right,
these three guys had stolen money off some people. And Papua New Guineans are very, like, community-focused. So if you're in, you're in. Like, you're in their little group. And mm-hmm. they will do anything to protect you.
Right.
So these three men stole money off one side, so the entire side came to kill these three men.
Right.
And they knew that, like, my dad was a Christian and we were there to do, like, good things, so they're like, off we go. I remember after it had all finished, these three guys were like, we came into your house because we knew God was here, and there's protection where God is, in their mind.
Yes, yes.
So they ran down onto the property and came into our house, and, like, we locked them inside to protect them, and then there was, like, 150 other people came and surrounded the house, and we're, like, all inside.
And what were they carrying? Did they have knives,
they
guns
had,
or whatever?
They didn't have guns. They had, like, machetes and bows and arrows, and they all had their little war paint on. Ooh. And they were all, like, chanting and yelling.
Did they have, like, fires? Was it nighttime or daytime?
It started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it didn't end till 10 o'clock that night. So it was just a really long
stressful. Out.
And I just remember it being really loud. Like, it was just really, really loud. And then after the situation had ended, I started, every time I'd hear noise, I'd get really freaked out, because I would remember that situation being surrounded by all those people. And it was so loud. Everyone was just yelling. And it was quite traumatizing, because they just wanted the three guys out of the house. So they didn't actually want to hurt us, but my dad was standing outside, like, to get the three guys, you have to kill me first, basically. And we could hear Dad saying that. We're like, shut up, Dad, don't.
Take that back.
So I don't know exactly what diffused the situation. It was just obviously, like, God, I guess. Mm. But they all just decided to leave. Okay. And then it just diffused really rapidly. It was weird after, like, 6 hours or whatever.
Okay. So up to that point, it had been relatively peaceful in your mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
There had been wars and fighting and stuff, but nothing that ever involved us.
Okay, because now this is in, not only on your doorstep.
Yeah, it was in our house. And, like, for the 12 years before that, like, there were tribal fights, and we would, like, watch people running up the road in their war paint or yelling and chanting. And it was exciting as a kid. It was like, oh, people are fighting. It's like... And in PNG, like, they get excited about weird things. So war was exciting.
Sure.
Up until that point. And then after that, like, I started to be a bit more scared.
Yeah.
And, like, every time I would hear noise, I would freak out. And when there was, like, there was another big fight that broke out, like, on another mountain, like, 2 or 3 weeks later. And we, from our house, you could see on the mountain. You could actually, it was like a movie.
Oh, wow.
And I've never felt like that in my life. I felt so terrified. It wasn't exciting. I just wanted to go hide inside. I was so, so scared.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so after, I was quite unsettled again. Mm-hmm. But then... maybe after 2 years after that experience, like in 2014-15, I realised that, like, it probably wouldn't happen again. Like, it hadn't happened again. No other people were coming, you know, into
the anxiety level sort of broke down a bit and I
was so happy. I was just really happy in my little life there. I was, like, doing school and I was teaching kindergarten and grade 1 and 2 with my mum. And so I was just busy and happy. Mm. My siblings weren't there, so there was no drama. Dad had left, so there wasn't, like, the stress of him being really sick as well, because we knew he was over here getting treatment, so there was...
Because he'd been sick most of your life, hadn't
he?
Yeah.
I can't remember him not being sick.
Okay.
So...
And to the point of near death on occasion sort of thing.
Yeah, a lot of the time. So then in 2015, in September, after all my anxiety had, like, chilled out and I was doing all right, like, this huge fight broke out again, and it was on our property again. And that, after that experience, because I had let my guard down and I was, like, happy again and I was all relaxed and fine, and then that happened again, and that one was really bad.
Mm.
Like, they were on our property, like, fighting across the property.
Whoa.
And... yeah, it was pretty traumatizing again. So then after
that... And these are, like, bloodshed, people getting cut open, machetes.
Yeah, like, people, like, there was these guys that, like, got shot in the head, and they like just came like with arrows. They had arrows like sticking out of their heads, and they're like on our veranda.
Because your mum was like a nurse.
My mum's like a trauma nurse, and so they're all like,
hey, I've got an arrow in my head.
And this other guy.
What are the end of their arrows like? Are they sort of just points?
They're like, they're pointed, but they've got heaps of barbs. Oh, so if you pull them out, you like pull out wood, and they're splinters wherever the arrow is.
Yeah, there. And bits of flesh, one would imagine.
Horrible. Horrible.
And you want to be a paramedic, right?
Yeah.
So you picked up some stuff.
Yeah, I did. Yep. I did indeed. But yeah, after that second fire, my dad wasn't there, and my dad was like a comfort zone for me because he'd been there for 30 years. He knew how to diffuse things.
Yes, diffuse. So calm.
But he wasn't there in this particular occasion. I remember calling him, and I was just bawling my eyes out, and I'm like, you need to get on a plane and come here right now. Yes, like, this fight is not ending.
Oh, and this was going on over days, was it?
Well, it was like getting into night time, and normally they all like, they're like, okay, we'll fight tomorrow, we're going home. But it was about midnight at this point, and they were still fighting. Like, were just, it was still going, and they were lighting fires and shooting like fiery arrows at each other, like across. And it was a horrible experience.
Yeah.
And then after that, it was about 3 weeks later, I think it was, me and Mum decided to come to Australia. Because it was just a lot to handle.
Just for two women on your own. Yeah. And was there any other, there was no other men like on the compound then, like as in
there was like
expats or anything?
My Papua New Guinea, I have like a guy that's like a dad to us.
Yep.
We just call him our Papua New Guinean dad, Joe. He was there.
Yep.
And he, like, he's very protective, and like there's, when he's there, I feel safe and feel comforted. But it was just such a horrible day that it was quite traumatising.
And for the normal person who hadn't been brought up there.
Yeah, it would have been.
Yeah, like, because you've said you're so used to that sort of stuff that it wasn't that unusual to see someone, you know, hacked with a machete or something.
Yeah, whatever.
Another injury, you know, your leg's fallen off or whatever. No big deal.
And I remember this lady as well, she came over to the house and a guy had, like, chopped off her whole breast, like, with a machete. And I saw that, and I was, because normally it's just the men that fight and the men that get hurt, but in this particular situation, it was like nothing was out of bounds. Like, they were hurting the women now too. And that's something that they don't do. Like, they, the men fight, and they leave the women and the children out of it.
So this was now accelerating.
Yeah, it was just, there was no rules going on in this war. Yeah. Like, it was really bad.
Yeah, yeah.
It was horrible.
A war without rules, who knew?
Quite scary.
I can imagine. So this kept sort of building up then, and there's this anxiety now.
Yeah.
Was your mum scared too, or she seems pretty hardy?
Yeah, I think she would have been, but she's not very good at expressing how she feels, I guess. Okay. And because
she didn't want to show you either maybe at the time.
Yeah. And, like, she's obviously not a qualified nurse, but, like, she has the brain of a qualified nurse.
Mm.
And so she knows, like, when something traumatic's going on, you don't let your emotions come in.
Yes, but, then you'll fall over, you see.
And she had, like, there was this one guy in particular that he had an arrow. Where was it? It was, oh, no, that's right. He got shot in the face, but the arrow hadn't gone into his brain, but they had to pull it out. But if they, like, nudged it, it would have gone into his brain. So she was, like, freaking out about getting this arrow out of this guy's face, and that was like, that took her like all night to do it, but she did it and he survived. We found this other doctor and like got him on a like on a taxi, I don't know what they called over there, and he came and helped her do it. So she was very involved in the medical side of the war, that
and
she
just sort of compartmentalize feeling, emotion, fear, anxiety, etc., and just go into the sort of left or right brain, whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly.
What do I need now to get through this? Wow, so it's an interesting childhood you got going on there.
There's
a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And so in a way, you probably, and this kind of leads into the second part of the story, we're going to talk about, you know, your journey out of that movement and all that sort of stuff. But it sounds like in that life, you've matured quite early. Mm. Like, you're not like a kid of 12. You're a sort of a woman of 12 to some degree, because you've had so much experience.
So much, and a lot of responsibility life. As well.
Yes, responsibility. And that's a big one. Because that's a big part of this movement. Responsibility is sort of part of the wording, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's Like, that's and what you do like, for and God. There's an,
yeah. Yeah, you have this responsibility to do a certain amount of things in order to, they wouldn't say it, but, like, to be good enough, I guess. Like, to be a good enough person to fit into their into the fundamentalist group.
Yep.
You have to, you know, do certain things and be a certain kind of person.
So that's sort of like the, what's the word, the implicit message, the message under the message sort of thing. It's not said in, explicitly in words, but it's sort of like...
The underlying message of it all. That's, and that's quite interesting, like, isn't it? Because my dad was such a well-known missionary, like everybody in the fundamentalist groups knew David Crowe, and I realise it now, but I didn't at the time, it, there was a lot of expectation to live up to being like David Crowe's daughter.
Ah, yes.
And I know my sisters have all felt it in the past as well, and my brother as well. And at the time I thought that I was, you know, teaching Sunday school because I loved God or all this, but it was... I was doing those things because I'm David Crowe's daughter. Like, I need to be a good missionary kid. And everyone was watching us. And my dad, a lot of our childhood, if we were doing something wrong, he would be like, people are watching us. Like, like, it was literally said quite a lot of the time. And it was like, people are watching us. So, like, you know, do the right thing. And when we would, like, do the wrong thing or threaten to rebel or leave home or whatever, Dad's like, that's it, I'm leaving the mission field, like, that's the end of it all here.
So and part of his status or position relied upon you guys doing the right thing, in a sense. So there was sort of a balancing act there where you had to conform for him to remain in his position. Yeah. Status in the eyes of what the rest of the group then, as in like the bigger group then.
And I now know, like when I was a kid, I resented my dad for it, and I thought that that was all Dad's fault. Like, you're just a bad dad because you want us to be perfect children. But now that I can see how the system works, I could see that Dad was caught up in the system, and he—that's what he thought needed to happen. Like, he was worried about man pleasing.
Yes, yes.
You know, he's not just a controlling person that wanted his children to be perfect. He was—he was worried, and what the system has taught you is that, like, as a missionary, if you have kids that aren't perfectly in line, you can't do God's work.
So you're what disqualified by your children's actions will disqualify you as the parent.
Yeah.
If they sort of rebel or get into a wrong relationship or something.
Yeah. And because, like, my sisters were young, teenage, like they were 16, 17, 18 at the stage where they want to leave home and get boyfriends or decide if they want to drink and do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They were threatening to do that kind of thing, and so Dad was like, that's fine, you can go do it, but if you do, I can't be a missionary anymore. So there was a lot of guilt because we're like, so if we choose to do what we want to do, we're taking Dad out of Papua New Guinea, we're taking Mum, who's a nurse and a school teacher, we drive people to the hospital, thousands of people get to know who God is through my dad. So if we, like if we choose to live the life we want,
And I know,
it was, for me it wasn't as bad as for my siblings because I was younger than they were. They were at the stage of leaving home, but I know that they felt that, like, pressure.
So it was sort of like this kind of very much an either-or situation. There wasn't sort of any there's no gray. So it's black or black white. You go, I'm out, you're out, everyone loses sort of thing in a
There's
sense.
There's no winning, no. Oh,
gee, that's a pretty big burden. Yeah. To have the, in a sense, the pressures of even the New Guinea people on your shoulders sort of thing.
And they, the Papua New Guineans as well, they look up to, they're quite racist against themselves. They think because they're black, they're not good enough, and they think white people are everything.
Oh, do they? Okay.
And so there was also, like, they didn't mean to put expectation on us, but they sort of did without realising there was so much expectation on us being perfect because we're white. Like, white people have it together. White people don't do bad stuff. White people don't struggle. Like, white people have it all.
Because they've only seen, and particularly before the internet, I presume, they hadn't really seen, I would imagine, other cultures in action.
No.
Like, they wouldn't have seen white culture and the, you know, say the ugliness of the slave trade and the, you know, the people smuggling and all the rubbish of the drug trade and everything. They wouldn't have seen that so much, like as we have seen growing up in movies and so forth. So they're white is good.
White is good. Like, if you've got white skin, all is well.
So they're buying into the lie to some degree. Okay.
Yes.
And you guys felt that. You felt that sort of.
A lot. A lot. And because they have such primitive, is that the right word? Yeah, primitive lives. And they don't, I don't know, you just want to help them. And you want to please them. You want to make their lives better because they do have difficult lives. Like
Because they die young, don't they?
Yeah. I think it's like 60 to 70. It's like you don't live past 70 if you do, like you are blessed.
And they lose a lot of kids, do they?
Yeah, people. Like, if they get sick, there's not, like, a good medical system. So if your kid gets pneumonia or whatever, they're practically dead. Or, and then the tribal fights, you never know what's going to happen. Or bush fight, like fires.
Mm-hmm.
And then in tribal fights, what they do as well, like, they sneak to the next village and they'll burn down their whole village. So people lose everything.
Whoa.
And then in a drought, they lose all their gardens, so they lose their food. So they do have quite difficult lives. So then our dad taught us to have massive hearts. Like, he taught us how to love them, like, unconditionally. So it was sort of you didn't want to let them down because their lives are hard enough as it is. Absolutely. So you'd sort of just do everything you possibly could to make their lives easier, which meant staying in the church system so that we could stay there to give them schools and education and better lives and clothes. And
right. And for you, for your sort of group then, it was really about staying within the system or else you couldn't do what you were doing either. Yeah. So it wasn't like a matter of, well, I love New Guinea, I can be in New Guinea anyway.
No.
Yeah, it was all tied in with the particular group because they were sent out by other people, weren't they? So they were sort of accountable to them, were they?
And I, like, because I have such a big heart for Papua New Guinea, when I was younger, I would always want to go back there as a missionary. But in my mind, the only way to go back there is to be sent out from an independent Baptist church and do things how my dad did them. So, yeah, there was no other way to live there unless you were one of them in their little church group.
Yeah, and they had sort of structures in place, didn't they, how things worked and how they got there and got their money and all that sort of stuff was sort of working for them. So it was kind of like, again, either all in
or
all out. And that's really a kind of a probably a good segue into the what happened when you were 15, because obviously you're 15, you've matured now and you're starting to think a lot more about perhaps some of those other things that are going on under the surface that's perhaps maybe other 15-year-olds, say, in Australia or America, we're just cruising along, living the teenage dream, just doing whatever you want. There's not a lot of maybe there's not a lot of thinking going on a deep, spiritual level because you're not caused to think.
No.
But you were, and you were on your own at this time, so you didn't have the sort of so much rigidness around you, perhaps. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I came to Australia when it was the end of 2015, start of 2016, and my dad, like, got me and mum out and said, I'll take you back in 3 months. So I came here with the expectation of going back there in 3 months.
Yeah.
And after 3 months, Dad was like, oh, I'm really sorry, like, your sisters need help, like, I can't leave them here. Give me another 3 months. And in that three-month period, I was just like an ordinary teenager. I just moved to Australia. I was like, wow, this is cool. I was making heaps of friends. And I wasn't thinking about anything. I finally didn't have responsibility, so I was just enjoying life. And then after the next 3 months that Dad added on to, like, now we're going to stay in Australia for three more months, I got really upset and, like, hit quite a massive wall of depression, I would say, probably, because I felt like Dad chose my two other sisters over me because I wanted to go back to Papua New Guinea.
That's of course, all you couldn't I wanted. Go back without him.
And I couldn't go back without him. And the only reason he was staying was for my two other sisters to help them out. And I felt like he chose them over me.
Yeah,
And I remember yelling at him in Sydney one day and I was in the car and I was bawling my eyes out. And I'm like, you don't love me. You love the two girls more than me. I just want to go back there. And then that day he was like, I'm really sorry, like, I'm not going to put a time limit on it anymore, we're probably not going back. No. So that's when I had to come to terms with completely changing my life. And it was quite strange to try and fit into an Australian society because I am very Papua New Guinean in my culture. Yeah. I was a simple thinker, didn't care about, like, what I wore, didn't care what I looked like, what people, I was just simple.
Mm.
And everything in PNG was simple. But here, as a teenager, it's complicated. Like, you got to have the nicest things and be cool and look good and to fit in. But I didn't have any of that because I wasn't, Yeah, so that's it was really quite hard.
Because it's quite, so in a sense, navigate, that's quite complex then. Because yeah. There's a sort of a nuance underneath, isn't there, as to what do I need to do to be in?
Yeah.
Because you'd been taught to be in was to do certain things in New Guinea, or to be in this group was to do the works of righteousness or service orientation, whereas in Australia it's a little bit more blurred.
It is. Yeah.
That's really interesting because I guess, were you sort of noticing that? Like you were sort of trying to compute that?
Yeah, and that's when I sort of became a lot more self-aware and started to be a deeper thinker and think into things a lot more when I was nearly 16 years old.
Yeah.
And then that's when my sister Tabitha moved to Newcastle and met Charlie Haddad, who is now the pastor of my family's church.
Yep.
So I sort of transitioned quite quickly into this whole new world, and I ended up going to Newcastle to visit my sister for a couple of weeks, but because my dad had made the decision not to go back to PNG, I ended up just living with my sister at this pastor's house, and that's when, my whole world changed again, and I got inserted into this, I don't know how you explain it, like super fundamental Baptist church, and it was really difficult because my whole world was put into question because this guy, Charlie, he's a fundamentalist. At the time, he was a Baptist pastor, but he was also very different to the other pastors, and he wasn't so much like, oh, just because you're David Crowe's daughter, that makes you like a good Baptist kid. He put everything in my world into question, and my whole life I had been I was a good person. I never rebelled. I didn't do anything wrong to Dad, and then this guy comes in, and he's like, oh, just because you're a missionary's kid doesn't mean anything. Like, are you even saved? Like, where are you going to go when you die? And he just started asking so many questions, and it was really confusing. I got really confused, and my sister Tab just was a completely different person after moving to this guy's house. She'd always been really fun and exciting and an adrenaline seeker, and I saw her and she was just really calm. She wanted to be a paramedic and she's like, no, I'm not going to be a paramedic anymore.
So she's got to dumb down a little bit.
Hugely, and it happened within like 3 to 4 weeks, like drastic things. Like
3 to 4 weeks?
Yeah, like huge things. About a week after I got there, so she'd only been there for like 2 or 3 days, she like came into the room and was like, I'm not allowed to go surfing ever again. I'm selling my surfboard.
She was a passionate outdoors girl.
And she was, all she wanted to do was become a paramedic. Like, she was not interested in marriage or kids. She
I remember that.
And watching her drastically change, I was like, what is going on here? Like, something is going on here. Because we've been in the church system forever. Like, we lived and breathed independent Baptist church circle. And we all were still quite normal in a sense, I guess.
You're still able to do surfing, become a paramedic, and
excited to have careers and do, you know, like we were all very driven kids. We weren't like lazy sitting around doing nothing. We were all very driven. And watching Tab was the most driven in the family, and watching her just give up everything, it was like something else is going on in this church, and I thought that was God. Like, I thought that what was changing my sister was the true God, the true, like, Christianity.
Right.
This is how it is, because my sister would never give up surfing. A week later, like, I know it's just surfing, but for her it was her world. Like, she was very obsessed with it.
Totally.
And then the week after it was paramedics. And she'd always wanted to be a paramedic. And then I remember she, like, comes out of the room one morning. She had quite a big smile on her face, but she was pretty upset. And she was like, I've done it. I quit paramedics.
A surrendering, was it? Yeah. Did you feel like that was between her and God, you mean?
She got into, like, more details as to what was going on in her heart. And it was like, God wants me to be fully surrendered, and he doesn't want me to be career-driven and fun-driven, and life is a lot more serious than we've always thought it was.
Okay, right. So it was very much this seriousness thing. Very serious. And these other things were, what, frivolity or, you know, just fun was like,
Yeah, and it's like, it's going to be burnt up one day. Like, it's not, yes. like, we need to, like, live for God now because, like, he's going to come back in the rapture soon or we could die at any moment and what's going to happen when we stand before God? Like, do I want to be like, sorry, God, I was so fun-driven that, like, I didn't think about you sort of
thing. So fun was not really in the God mode sort of thing. So you were in God mode and that didn't involve fun, or you were in fun mode and that didn't involve God sort of thing.
Again, like, no grey. There's black and white. Like, if you want God, you can't have anything else sort of thing.
Which is quite extreme, isn't it? Because it's very difficult to live long term. Like, well, you can do that in the short term and put aside. You can sort of, you start to see cracks fairly quickly when you're over on the all black or the all white side. Because you know you can't keep it up in a way.
Yeah, no, no, exactly. And I think seeing someone that I never thought would change so drastically, I was convinced without a shadow of a doubt that that was true Christianity and that was God.
So this big conversion type thing.
And like, what would convert her other than God? Like, in my mind, because it was such a big conversion.
In such a short time.
Such a short time. And I think obviously God is in everything. So he has, you know, he was obviously in that. But now in hindsight, I can see that the pressure she was getting from the pastor. And he wasn't directly putting pressure on her, but he just lived a certain way in it. I don't know. That's her story, though. Like,
and particularly when you're in the house. She was living in the household, was she?
Yeah.
So you kind of, and again, you were just talking earlier about the living and breathing of that. Just what I just put that little agenda. Remember you said before about your week, what a week was like in this movement, like what you did? Can you just run us through that briefly?
Yeah, so in this particular church that my family's in now, it became, you were so involved in each other that Tuesday night we had Bible Institute, Wednesday night we had Bible Institute, and after that we had prayer meeting. Then Thursday morning we had prayer meeting, Friday night we had youth group, Saturday morning we'd go out onto the streets for outreach, and then...
Was that for an hour or a few hours or...?
Anywhere from like 3 to 5 hours, and then like the boys would go out again on Saturday night, like into like the clubbing section of Newcastle, and like preach on the streets again. And then Sunday morning was Sunday morning service, and then Sunday night church. So it was 6 days a week of being very involved in each other, and it became like there was no such thing as like family units and. No one was separate. We were all one big happy family.
Right. And in the mind of those people, as we talked about earlier, they would say to themselves, well, all are one in Christ here. We have a oneness of spirit, and therefore we are, you know, fulfilling God's laws and doing good things here by unifying to this. But outside of that group, they would see they weren't as part of that. They were sort of separate from those outside. Yeah.
And it has progressed and gotten a lot worse. Like when we first got there, they were a lot more... in with other churches.
Whereas, so they had a sort of a network.
Yeah, they had a network where we were all one. So there was a few churches that were part of our oneness.
Oh, I see. Whereas, so that was like a group but with very similar belief structures.
Yeah.
Again, so, called Independent Baptists. So they were sort of, the label was there that you're in if you're independent. Independent from whatever. Okay, I get it.
Yep, so we had oneness with a few other churches. And everything was awesome, and it was awesome at the start when I first was there. It was really encouraging, and because I honestly did think that that was what Christianity was, I just threw myself into it. And there was so much support, and there's so much love, and people will do anything for you in that system.
That's true.
It was awesome.
And this is a very positive side of this, isn't it? It's very community-based.
Yeah, it was very exciting, and because we were hanging out like 6-7 days a week, like you're so involved in each other, like you're all each other's best friends, you know everything about each other.
Nothing's hidden.
Nothing's hidden, and at the time, it was really cool. It was very exciting.
Part of something that's... got momentum, and it's sort of like you're going somewhere, aren't you? You're part of a movement that's got some legs, so to speak, and it's taking you place. You're doing positive things for the world, etc.
And because of like our upbringing, in the sense where we had to do the right thing, I now looking back in hindsight, I can see that I brought that into, like, this next section of my life when I was 15, 16 and stuff. Sure. And when I would do good things or I would make steps and I'd be like, oh, I'm going to throw out these clothes or I'm going to give up my, like, thoughts of being a career woman and all this.
Because those things are bad.
Yeah, those things are frowned upon. And every time I would make a good step, there was so much encouragement and people would be like, yes,
rallying
go,
around.
That's awesome.
Good on
your book. And because I was such a people pleaser and I needed people's approval in order to feel and think I was doing the right thing, I was like, yes, this is right. I am getting the approval of my whole family. I'm getting the approval of my pastor and the church. I must be doing the right thing here.
And do you think that that's sort of part of what is the appeal of these groups, these sort of cultish type groups that sort of draw people in very closely, and you do get quite a lot of accolades within that group, don't you? If you perform at a certain level, you're in. Absolutely. And you're, and like we were saying earlier, you're all in, you know, like you'll get looked after, there'll be people will lend you their cars, they'll give you money.
Yep.
Left, right and centre, they'll, like what else you say, they'll bring you into their home.
Yeah. Anything. Like because we did, me and my sister Tab didn't have anywhere to live.
Yeah, and they straight in.
Like straight in, like gave us a whole section of the house sort of thing, and we're part of the family.
Yes, and this sort of happened so not only, but almost immediately.
Immediately. It was amazing.
And that has a great deal of attraction, doesn't it? When you, particularly, I can imagine for yourself, and just sort of thinking in hindsight, here you are, you're kind of a bit isolated now. Now, you weren't with your parents, were you? You weren't even living with your parents for some reason. So I can't remember what that was.
My mum and dad were living in Gosford, and they had an apartment that only had one bedroom.
Right.
And
that's right.
Dad was there. I think he was getting treatment. I'm not sure what was happening. Right. But they didn't have room in their apartment for us. And then what happened shortly after that was Dad saw that me and my sister were quite comfortable and happy with this pastor. And we, according to my dad, we weren't living in sin anymore. And he was really happy that we were thriving in the church. He was so excited. So he decided to go back to PNG.
Without
me, but he did give me the option. He said, you can come with us now. It was about a year after he said we were never going back.
Yep.
But I was so inserted into the church and I was stage. I was just really happy. I studied aged care, so I had a really good job at the time and everything was going really well. So I was like, no, you guys go and I'll stay here. So he did give me the choice to go back, but at that time I had just gotten over my grief of leaving PNG, and I was doing okay, so I didn't want to, like, go back and then have to go through all that again.
And knowing that your dad was fairly volatile health-wise, it wasn't necessary he's going to be back there forever.
No,
so like, could be back again in the next 6 months or whatever.
And my sister was dating Buddy at the time, so they were going to get married, so we knew Mum and Dad would be back for their wedding.
Right.
And, yeah. So,
she connected with another guy within the church who was one of the leaders of the church sort of thing.
He was one of Charlie's best friends, so the pastor's one of his best friends.
Yeah.
And my sister connected with him within, like, within those few week periods of giving up the surfing and the paralytics. What I saw what was happening was this guy was so involved and he's just very passionate. And he makes everything that he's involved in, he makes it exciting. Like, it's just the best.
Yeah, he's got a dynamic energy and he's sort of like absolutely full on, you would say, isn't he? Absolutely super, full of life and energy towards, in a sense that, I can't think of the word, but passion is a good word, but there's sort of another one where it's like,
a
clenched fist sort of.
Yeah, super, he was consumed with it. He was consumed with it. And my sister connected with him within like 2 or 3 weeks of moving to this new place.
And that's very much honoured in that system, isn't it? The consumption of you into God, the loss of you is very much honoured, isn't it? So if you're not there, in a sense, and consumed by God, they don't want you. They want you to be lost.
That's so true. That's
and again, it's based on, you know, the death to the self and the crucified, person in Christ. I'm crucified in Christ, which is also true. And so much, you know, there's good and bad, and yet you can see where the motivation comes from. But the loss of person is not towards more of Christ. It seems like there's more of the other people. You become like one of the other people, seemingly, like a clone. That's a good word. Tell us a bit about that.
That's happened to me.
Because you mentioned you felt like a bit of a clone.
I felt like a clone because I felt like I was trying to become a clone of my sister Tabitha.
Ah,
because she...
Of course, she's older than you.
Yeah, and it was strange because growing up, me and Tab never got along. Yeah. We were like, we just hated each other. And I was friends with Elizabeth, and then Tabitha and Livia were friends. We had a very separate sibling group. Yeah. And that's why it was really strange. So when I moved into Charlie's house with her and I saw her give up everything she ever loved and she just transformed into this, you know, for me at the time, she was this incredible human.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I love that. And she was happy. Like, she had joy about giving up all this stuff. And I was like, how? I don't understand.
I don't
want to
give it up.
I don't want to. And she... never wanted to get married, never wanted to have kids, and she met Buddy within these few weeks, and she's like, I want to get married, and I saw this insane transformation, and I was like, I want that, man, I want to be like my sister, but in reality, I am built so differently to everyone else, and I lost myself in it all, like, in order to be anything like her, I had to get rid of me and who I really was, and I just cloned. I cloned into, it's not like people said I had to be a certain thing, but I knew if I didn't become what my sister was becoming, then I was going to be on the out. And then my other sisters moved to Newcastle, my brother moved to Newcastle, when they were all transforming into people that they just weren't. They gave, like, they just lost themselves, but I couldn't see that at the time, so I was like, I need to be like my siblings, I need to...
So there's this real strong power there, it feels like, then. So people come from sort of somewhere else and to this particular place, venue, town in this case, but more like the community, and all of a sudden there's this transformed life, but initially what seems like it's sort of like God, but then you see... Actually, everyone's sort of looking a bit the same.
Yeah.
There's a sameness. There's a sort of a cloning going on in amongst the people. And then that's all, I guess, kept going by the affirmation of the other. Oh, look, you're becoming like us.
Yeah.
Become more like us.
And it's exciting and you're, like, so welcomed when you become like them and it's awesome.
So it's
like
a big payoff.
It's a huge payoff.
Particularly to a younger person.
Huge payoff.
I think we all
and
want
because
that.
I was like, I had moved to Australia and I didn't fit in with the ordinary group of people
of
my age.
That's right.
I now
you were very unlike them.
Yeah, I was so unlike them. And I wasn't into what being an Australian teenager is. Like, I didn't care about social media and boys. I just didn't care about it.
Yeah.
So then now I had found my new group, my people that
my
accepted
people.
Me for who I was. And I felt, for the first time in a while, I just felt completely accepted and at peace, and I was happy. So I just kept going further and further into
absolutely. I can imagine that. Yeah, totally. Because that's what I think we all want, that, and we all want that acceptance. Let's think about that, because there's a lot. You give up a lot and you have to sort of become like the group. But what happened when you decided, or you started to work through that and think, well, hang on, I'm lost myself here. And this was... How long before that happened? A year? Was it even that long or not?
I was pretty inserted into the church from like 2016 to 2018, so about 2 years.
Oh, 2 years, okay. So
I had my struggles, and even through all of that and my cloning, I was still very different.
Okay.
And there was always something about me that just couldn't quite do it. I was not
couldn't quite make the grade.
I was not quite good enough. Like, there was just... a lot lacking, and at the time I just really struggled, and I was like, what's wrong with me? And I would keep on, like, falling into sin as such, what they would say, like falling into sin. Like, I just loved music. Music for me is like a massive way that I would vent and, like, you know, deal with my emotions. And you're not allowed to listen to secular music.
Yep.
So I would keep on listening to secular music. So therefore, I was on the out, and I would feel so guilty. Like, every time I would go and listen to music, I'm like, I felt like I was going to go to hell because I was like,
that's extreme, isn't it?
Yeah,
so
it was horrible.
So small things become big, in a sense. So small sort of things that people wouldn't even give a thought to, and now you're going to go to hell if you listen to music or
and it's not
have a
like
drink
they
or something.
They don't say those exact words, but that's how they make you feel. But then, in a sense, they've covered their ass because you can't go and say, well, you said this to me.
So it's
because
really
they haven't said that. It's
underneath.
Yeah, it's like... just vibes. They give out vibes. Like, you just...
But they're very powerful vibes then, because when you go away
vibes.
From the group, and what's the group what's the word? What's the story for those that would leave the group then? What would happen to those people that left? Hang on, I'm not fitting in here. I don't like what's happening. I'm going to be leaving now. Or, you know, you have an argument or you disagree with. What happens to those people? What's the story about those people?
Those people, everyone that had left, well, there wasn't a lot that left before me.
Yeah.
But the ones that had left, I didn't know the real reasons that they left. So what we were told was that they were rebelling against God and that they were, like, living in sin.
Living in sin.
And basically they were just finished as Christians. God was never going to use them until they came back to the church.
Right.
And
so they were just on their way back in. They had to come back through this particular church again.
And if they didn't, it was sort of like just the terminology that was used. What it was more like, oh, man, brother, they're just finished. Like, they're finished. Their Christianity's finished. Like, it's so sad, like, seeing people walk away from God. And at the time, like, now I know those people and I've talked to them, and that's so not what was happening. They were leaving because they wanted to know God more.
Isn't that interesting? So they were stretching their wings. They wanted questions. They wanted the ability to say, well, hang on a minute, I'm sure there's something bigger. God's maybe a bit bigger than this little small movement.
Yeah.
But they were kind of written off, and there was like a bit of propaganda then around them for those that were stayed behind.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of a story told to the group about that person. Oh, they're bad, they're out. God's finished with them.
Like, they were quite intent. They were sort of like me in a sense where they would speak up about how they felt. And before so they spoke up, to Charlie, but we didn't know, like, I didn't know the details of what was going on.
Ah, I get it, yeah.
But it was like, man, these people are super rebellious. They're, like, speaking out against the pastor. Like, what are they doing? This is hectic.
You can't do that. Yeah, you can't question the pastor. No. He's like, so what's in this movement? What position is the pastor in? Is he sort of like the mediator? How does he get so much power? It's always
It's always a he. There's no women in power. He is our under-shepherd. So basically this is what they call him anyway.
Yeah.
He gives an account for us to God. So anything that we do is basically his fault because he's our leader. Wow. So he's...
So like your dad thing, same as your dad.
Yeah.
He's responsible for you as children. And if you muck up, he's in trouble.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
wow.
So that's why in this particular church, it's like the family unit was destroyed because now it was like Charlie was our dad, basically. He was the dad of the husbands and the wives and everyone.
Had a big position of power. Massive but also
position of power.
A lot of pressure, I must imagine. Now he has to make sure that all of his flock, all of his sheep, are doing okay, not sinning or doing the wrong thing, because otherwise he's accountable.
Yeah, and like...
No wonder they go and use control and manipulation.
And I really have struggled with my feelings towards him.
Yeah.
But, like, when I really... Because in my mind he's hurt me and kind of destroyed my life and my family.
Of course.
But when I really think about it, he's sort of like the rest of us. He's lost. He's just trying to make the mark. He's trying to be good enough.
And he believes genuinely that he's doing the right thing, doesn't he?
He really does.
You can see that from outside.
Yeah.
I understand how much that... And you had a lot of anger when you first left, didn't you?
A lot of anger towards him.
Because anyway, sorry, I'm going a little bit beyond it, but just back up a little bit, you actually decided eventually, though, that you just
I saw these people leaving, and then there was one girl in particular that I was quite good friends with, and she left, and she was, like, really happy to leave, and she... I don't know, she didn't think that this church was everything.
Yep.
But in my heart, like, if I left this place, I was finished because I could see what, like, they were saying about everyone else. And I'm like, if I leave, I'm done. And there was a few situations that I had, like, I had, you know, made mistakes and I stuffed up according to them. And I was treated in a certain way that they would say was right. Like, they're like, we just love you and we're trying to get you back on track for God.
Yeah.
And a big part of me believed that, but then they offended me so deeply and said some really harsh, horrible things to me defined me as a certain person. Like, I was these certain kinds of things. And I don't know, I thought that it was coming from God because I genuinely believed that this place was, like, the only right place.
Of course. That's the mentality, isn't it? Yeah. That's the story within the story in this group. Yeah.
So I sort of came to a position and I said to God, I'm really sorry, but I can't have anything to do with you, because I didn't actually believe that there was another way. Like, I thought that leaving there, like if I left there, again, black and white, no grey, if I left, then I couldn't have God.
Yes.
That I couldn't stay and be under people that were just awful, like that would treat me. Like I felt I made a mistake and I was 18 years old. There was this situation with these guys, like nothing had happened. I just had feelings for someone that I wasn't technically allowed to have feelings for. And nothing had happened, but it was like because I had gone against the rules and I had feelings for someone that I wasn't allowed to have feelings for, and I went against their rules. It was I was marked as a whore, I was marked as all these certain things, and I made an agreement with that in my heart, and I was like, yes, okay, I am all these things, and if I leave, I can't have God anymore. So I either need to stay here and help, like, let them help me and, like, you know, get over my struggles and I'll be here for the rest of my life.
Like a life sentence.
Yeah. But I loved God so much and there's something in me. Like, I just wanted God more than anything. Like, I 100%. He's such an important thing in my life. But I came, it's pretty sad, really, but I came to a point in my life where I was like, I don't want you, God, because I don't want these people. So I don't want you either.
And is that then the part of that movement then is that it's so identified as the only way, really, like it's so, and that's really both the explicit and implicit message all the way through, isn't it? That if you're not coming here and if you're not showing up regularly and if you're not part of this group, you're not in at all.
You're not in.
You're actually all the way out, kind of out of darkness almost feeling, isn't it, that you're right out. So the choice is pretty big, isn't it, to get out then?
It was pretty massive. And I started having those thoughts of leaving in 2018. And I entertained the thought of leaving, but then I knew, because I knew what happened to everyone else that left. Like, you're on the out. You are not, like, you don't have God anymore. Like, God sort of finished with you until you come back.
And from a family standpoint, you're getting off, like, you're not part of the family even, to a great degree.
And I was quite close to my family. Like, I had the three sisters and my brother and, like, I don't know, we were all fairly close. So losing them would have been a pretty big deal for me. So then I counted the cost of leaving in 2018 and I decided that it wasn't worth it. It was too hard.
Much loss, really, because you were going to lose everything if you went. Yeah,
and I, like, my whole life was that, you know, David Crowe's missionary kid. So it wasn't just from my church. I'm like, everyone in Australia is going to know that I left home and I ran away from church. And
you're almost blackballed now. Yeah. That's it. You've got a mark, a stamp.
Literally, like, they stamp you and I couldn't go anywhere else without everyone knowing what I had done. So I decided to stay. And that's when I made an agreement with everything that they had said to me. So I accepted it all. And I'm like, okay, I am I am who you say that I am, basically.
That's terrible.
And then luckily, I just right after I had sort of agreed with everything they said, I went on holidays for 3 weeks and it was just the perfect timing. And I went away and I was with this awesome family and I sort of was telling them everything that was happening. And they were on the in another independent Baptist church, so their opinion held quite a lot of weight with me. And they were like, this is messed up. They're in the same sort of circle as us. Yes. And they were saying what was happening in my church was just wrong and messed up. And so I entertained those thoughts for 3 weeks while I was on holidays. And 3 weeks, I guess, was long enough for my thoughts to breed and stick well enough that when I got home, I was like, no, I'm leaving. I don't know how. And it took me a year after that point to actually get out. But that was when I decided somehow, some way I'm getting out of here. Like, I need out of this church, because this is, like, other churches are saying that what's happening in our church is weird.
That's right.
So something must be wrong.
Left wing, something right wing, whatever they call it.
Exactly. So
that's really interesting, but it still took you a year.
It took me a year.
In a way, like, if someone was listening to this, they might be in that same situation thinking, man, it's hard to get out. Yeah. Someone else is looking at it and thinking, well, did they have bars around you? Was there a prison? Did they have the doors locked? It was nothing like that, was it?
No, it was. I've said to my uncle Tony before, it's like, in my mind, I was in a glass box. Glass box. So it's not like a physical restraint. There's nothing physical there.
Yeah.
Because they're really good at, like, covering themselves. they...
Yes, it's not an obvious page, is it?
And you can't accuse them of anything because they, technically, they haven't actually done anything to me, really. Yes,
they haven't locked you in a cage. No, it's not like one of those cults where they've got people locked downstairs or anything like that. It's nothing along those lines.
Not at all. And I was free to leave at any point in time, but my fear held me there.
Yeah. And the consequences of that action... Yep. Which you can tell us about in a minute, are pretty big, aren't they? And they're real. They're not like, oh, we're going to do this, but when you leave, they don't do it.
Yep.
They actually do follow through with their threats.
Yeah, they
do. Of expulsion. And what's the word when you leave a group and you can't, like we talked about it earlier? You're excommunicated.
Yeah. But the thing about it was that if I had of not been scared and I just stood up to Charlie and said, hey, I'm going to leave, I could have gotten out without being shunned. They wouldn't have had anything against me.
Right.
They wouldn't have had any...
You just leave on your own accord.
Yeah. Right. I would have been on the out. They would have treated me like I was an alien, but they technically wouldn't have had anything against me because I didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
But I was so driven by my fear, and for some reason that pastor terrified me because he's like, you know, he's a big Lebanese dude. He's really intense. Very he's really scary.
Yeah,
no, and I honestly thought that, like, he was God. Like, he had this direct line to God, and everything that Charlie was saying was coming from God.
Absolutely.
And I remember my dad, because my dad's opinion has a lot of weight with me, and I remember he once said, Charlie Haddad is the closest thing to Jesus on earth. And those words, when he said that, I was like, okay, wow. Wow, because my dad was a wise man, and for him to think that, like, oh,
that's right, he's not stupid, but he's been drawn in somehow. That's a big saying, isn't it?
So I sort of let that kind of, like, take control over my feelings, and instead of just standing up to Charlie and saying, listen, I'm out of here, I kind of struggled my way through the next 12 months, and I did. I went to his house once, I remember, after church one day. I sat him down, and I was like, Charlie, I'm never coming back to your church. I'm out. I got the words out. I got it all out.
Yeah.
And he scared me to death. He was like, if you leave Hadassah, like, you're going to be in the hands of the devil. The devil's going to have, like, you're in the devil's playground.
Yep.
And he's going to have a field day with you, and you're just going to be finished. And because there's this underlying sense of, like, I want God, I'm like, wow, okay, if I leave, I don't have God anymore.
And who wants to be, you know, consumed by the devil, the evil one is going to take you.
That's a scary thought.
Of course it is.
Oh, so that was about 4 months before I left at that point. So I said, okay, that's fine, but I'm going to stop coming to every other service, and I'm just going to come on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And that was another massive step in me leaving, because not hanging out with them those six other days of the week, I started to be able to think more clearly, because I didn't have their influence, and I would get home from work and I would just go straight to bed. I wasn't, like, hanging out with anyone. I wasn't influenced by anyone at that point in time. So
the
influence
is really part of the glass cage, then, is that there's both the affirmation and the negatives and the fear sort of form the walls of the cage or the glass,
and it's,
whatever.
And it is glass, because for me it was like I could see out of it, but I couldn't get out of it.
Wow.
So it wasn't like I couldn't see past, and it was like this wooden box where you can't see past to the next thing. It was like glass, and I was in this box with all these people living a certain life, but I could see. Yeah. I could see that there was something else. Yeah, it really was.
I can see that. Because it's almost just there, but you can't
I couldn't get it
out of the box.
And I was, there was a huge part of me that truly believed that what was going on in this, like, little group was the only way. So it's like, okay, if I choose to smash the glass and I go out, the glass is smashed and I can't get back in. Like, I'm out now.
Right. So, isn't that symbolism of breaking the glass and can't be put back together?
No.
And in a sense, that's become very true, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Like, the reality now of you leaving has, it's lived out that. That's the glass is broken, there's no going back, there's, you know, the separation and stuff that's come.
Yeah. Which for me now is awesome. Like, I'm glad that glass is broken, because...
Right, if you could go back, like you
said,
if
I could put it back together, I probably would go back. But because it's smashed beyond repair, I can't. So at the time, I just... Yeah, I sort of distanced myself from everyone. I pulled back for about 3 to 4 months, and then I went to my dad.
Yep.
And I just said, I'm moving out of home. I'm leaving and I'm just going to do it. And I asked him, because in the independent Baptist circles, there's church discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So if they deem you worthy of you being like a horrific sinner, they'll put you under church discipline, which means according to their rule book, they're not allowed to talk to you anymore. Yeah. Because I was a member of the church, I had signed a piece of paper, signed my life away to the church.
Yes, that's right. So that was significant, wasn't it? Just signing, this is what got you in a bit of trouble, is that you sort of, once you sign your life over to this church, in a way, there's a greater, even bigger responsibility to act a certain way, speak a certain way.
Because if you're just, like if you just go to the church service on a Sunday morning.
Yep.
You have no obligation to the church. Like, you just go there. Okay. Whereas I was, like, I signed it. I was a member. They had a big meeting.
Okay. Oh, yeah. To say yes to you, was it?
Everyone had to take a vote. Like, Charlie stood up the front and, like, said, look, I want Hadassah to be part of our church.
Yeah.
Our church, sorry. Like, I've seen her grow in the Lord and she's doing well. So
whoever's
in vote, say yes or no. And everyone said yes, so I was in. Yep. I was officially proper in.
And not realising at the time what that might come out like, or what the repercussions.
I thought it was the best thing ever. Yeah, I thought it was the best. I was excited because once you're in, you can start teaching Sunday school and be part of the choir and stuff.
Oh, I see. Until you sign on, then you can only be a spectator to some degree.
Yeah.
Pew warmer. Yep. That's sort of the word that's used in a sense. So in a way, there's a sort of terminology within the group that if you're on the outer, you're kind of not as respected as if you're in the inner circle. Yep. Is that how it works?
Yeah.
So you can't do
you can't. Yeah, you can't do. Yeah, you can't be involved in anything. Like, you can go to outreach on a Saturday because everyone can do that.
Yep.
But you can't have any involvement in the church functions.
Ah, okay. So what they would call leadership roles or something. Yeah. You don't have any.
Yes.
Ah,
because once you've signed the paper, you have agreed to live a certain way. So there's a dress code.
Is that written?
Yep.
Okay. So you can read it and go la 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 la.
Yeah. So you weren't allowed to, like, drink. You weren't allowed to, obviously, like, touch a guy or whatever. Like, if you're going to date someone, you had to do it, like, the right way with the dad's approval, the pastor's approval.
Chaperones, etc.
You had to, there was a dress code for church.
Yep.
There was just a few things that you had to do.
Yeah. And sort of bullet points. Yeah. If I want to do, I have to conform to these laws or whatever. It's sort of kind of like the contract.
Yep.
And you sort of sigh as you do with a contract, you're like, oh, yeah, I agree with all that. It'll do. That's okay.
And at the time I did, I was like, you know, I did all those things. And then after I had told, like, 4 months before I left home and I told Charlie I was never going back to church, he was like, listen, I don't want you involved in the ministries. And I was like, obviously I don't want to be.
Yeah, that's right.
So I stepped down from ministry, but I was still a member.
So they're thinking in their minds, I should be back sort of thing.
Yeah. Just give her some time. Yep. You know, because Charlie knew that I was really angry at him for the situation that had happened previously, with him being really hard on me, with, like, when I had made that mistake.
Yeah,
he knew that I was really upset, and he was like, you just need time.
Right. So he wasn't taking any responsibility for that. It was your problem.
Yes. He was, honestly, just get over was completely
give her some time. Yeah. She'll get over it. Yeah. We can call her whatever we want and label her and shame her and so forth, but that's fine.
And it was like, I sort of demanded an apology from people, but they wouldn't. They apologised in the sense where they're like, oh, we're sorry that you got offended, but, like, what we said was right.
Oh, the old pseudo-apology. It's not an apology at all.
It's not at all.
It's not at all.
And
it doesn't touch you, does it? Like, an apology is very much a two-person agreement about the situation.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry that I spoke to you that way. That was my fault. And you're like, yeah, I accept that. You know, it's like, yeah, it's a relational thing, isn't it? Whereas this sort of thing is, that's just what it is.
It is. Get over it. Like, it happened. We were in the right. And the truth hurts. And it's like Christianity's brutal. Like, God isn't soft. Like, God is, like, you know, he's hectic and he's hard on sin. And, the Bible says, God is angry with the wicked every day.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's just a lot of hatred and anger and just harshness.
It's not this. And so their love, and they genuinely believe then, do they, that love takes these sort of actions. Yeah. That it actually calls out people, shames them, you know, lays heavy burdens of guilt on them and shame and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
They genuinely believe that, don't they?
With their whole heart. They really do.
Because they act.
They really do.
The belief is there, but they act out of those beliefs daily to try and reinforce.
Yep.
And anyone who doesn't line up, well, they have to be out.
Yep.
So is that what happened when you left? Like, you got the guts up to leave.
So I got the guts up to tell my dad that I was leaving. And I asked him, I said, is me leaving home against your wishes, is that worthy of being disciplined and being shunned?
Yep.
And he said to me, he was like, I don't think Charlie would initiate that, but as your father, I believe that you're stepping into dangerous waters. So I would discipline you for your own safety. And I remember that night I was just so upset because I just wanted to leave home. I was still going to go to the church on a Sunday morning, but I wanted to distance myself more. Yes. But knowing that if I left home I was going to be shunned, I was like, man alive. But it's if I stayed there, I was getting so angry. I was getting fed up. I was sick of it. I was done pleasing the system. I did not care anymore. So I was to the point where I didn't care.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Because getting back to that earlier part where you get the affirmation, you're not getting, so eventually there's nothing coming back now. All you've got is the anger and the shame and the guilt and the crap.
Yep.
And you're looking at the other side and going, well, there's no payoff now.
Exactly. Why would I start? There's no point.
There's no point.
And I wasn't really, I'd rather lose to get rid of this stuff. Because I was in such a bad place and I was so... I can't even explain. My brain was just mayhem. It was so I was so confused.
I'm not surprised.
And it was just like, I'm going to lose my entire family. I'm going to lose everyone. I'm going to lose everything that I've ever known. But, like, I cannot stay here. And I was so angry and fed up with the system. I just, after my dad said that to me, I got in my car and I drove to Melbourne to see a friend.
Yeah.
And I just gave up on it all. I was like, I don't care. Like, give me the booze, give me the boys. I don't care. Like, I'm out. And I knew that the only way out now was to be disciplined.
Yeah.
So I... sort of was like, just give me the world. Yeah. Give me the world. I just want to, I did. Yep. And I went home and my sister had somehow gotten into my Facebook account and had read all my messages. So that's she right. knew what had so happened in Melbourne because I messaged you.
That's right.
I told you what had happened in Melbourne and she read my messages to you.
Yeah.
And so my parents come and get me.
Which is pretty wild, what happened in Melbourne.
It was nothing.
Honestly, it was nothing.
It was nothing, but at the time it was such a big deal for me. Like, and for them. And for them.
Yes.
And now in hindsight, it's nothing. But it was like the biggest deal, like Hadassah drank alcohol. Like, and I kissed a guy and they, what did they say? They're like, what was the word? What's the word that the IBs use? Not adultery, the other word. Fornication.
Fornication.
I fornicated.
Like so
I was a fornicator and a drunkard because I had gotten drunk and I had kissed this guy. So my parents come and they like dragged me out of bed. It was like 11 o'clock at night and I was asleep. They dragged me out of bed and they like sit me down in the living room and they're like, my mum was distraught and she's like, Hadassah, we know what's happened in Melbourne. Like, tell us the whole story. So I told them and I was like, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I don't care. And I was so cold and shut off at this point in time that my mum was sitting there. She was so upset. She was bawling her eyes out. My dad was really upset. And he was like, can I say, how do we fix this? Like, we need to get this right with the church. We need to do the right thing. Or, like, it's church discipline. And I was like, I don't know how to get it right with the church because I don't want to live here.
And I don't want to be.
And I didn't want to live at home with my parents, not because I had an issue with my parents, but because I knew I was upsetting them every day because I was going against their rules. Mm. And that's like, it was really upsetting because I love my dad. Like, I love my parents so much and I didn't want to upset them anymore. So I'm like, I can't keep doing this to you and I can't keep doing it to me either. So then the next day they brought the pastor around and I was so angry at him at this point in time. He's like, so tell me what happened. So I told him the story and he's like, you're a fornicator and you're a drunkard. Like, no, I'm not. Like, I made a mistake. Like, I stuffed up. And he was like, are you sorry for it? And I said, if I'm sorry, does that mean I have to stay? Like, do I have to, you know? And he's like, yeah, well, if you're sorry, we'll go to the church and we'll tell them what's happened.
But
if you're repentant, like, you know, it'll be fine. We'll move on.
Yeah.
And I just... I remember thinking, this is my out. Yes. Like, I'm like, this is it.
He had no idea what you were actually asking.
No, he had no idea. And I remember just sitting in my lounge room and I'm like, this is it. I can actually use this to my advantage. I can manipulate the situation.
That's right.
So I said to Charlie, I'm like, discipline me. I said, just put me under discipline. And I said to him, I said, Charlie, I dislike you so much.
I dislike you so much
that the thought of you never being allowed, you're not allowed to talk to me now. Awesome. So the fact that you're not allowed to talk to me, do you know how happy that makes me? I was in such, I just didn't care at this point in time. I was so cold.
You need that anger to propel you. And I think that's what happens in all situations like this where we feel trapped. Until we get our anger is our impetus out, it's our power to burst out of the situation, isn't it?
To break the glass.
You don't break the glass until you get angry enough and you smash it on the ground. In this case, get your hammer and belt yourself out.
It had to happen like that. And
great imagery.
And it's not like it's something that you can't continue in for a long time, because otherwise as a person you'll just be depressed and destroyed if you live in that anger, but you need it.
You need it. Exactly.
Otherwise I never would have left. So I sort of gave over to the anger and the hatred, and then I just was like, I just don't care about yous anymore.
And that's a big thing, isn't it? Because again, for those people who wouldn't know about this sort of group, but if you'd seen a lot of fundamentalist groups, anger's the worst thing ever. That's the biggest sin in their minds. Yeah. Even though they act out of anger all the time, they kind of tend to disguise it underneath sort of other virtuous gifts. Oh, this is love. No, it's not. It's anger.
Yeah, and it's what do they say about the anger?
Righteous anger.
Righteous anger.
That's right. So they sort of categorised it in a sense. Yes. Said, well, there's the righteous anger, which is like the church discipline anger, where we sort of come down on people and rail on them and call them names and all this sort of stuff. So anger's okay, but let's not hold it, let's not stay with it, but it's the biggest sin ever, so we have to disguise our anger and call your anger wrong.
Yeah.
So it's like a manipulative thing. So Hadassah's angry.
I was labelled. The labelling that came with that situation.
An angry person.
Yeah, at the time I sort of pretended I didn't care, but then after leaving I was so insecure in myself. I thought I was just, I thought I was a whore.
Yeah.
I thought I was a drunkard and like an alcoholic. I had gotten drunk twice and I thought I was an alcoholic. How they make you feel.
So
I had that meeting and I said to Charlie, put me under church discipline, and then I packed my stuff and Charlie told me as well in that conversation that if I was alive in 1 year, God's grace was far too sufficient. God was way too good. And if I was alive in 2 years, then I wasn't saved. So he was saying that God, if I was a Christian, I was God was going to kill me for what I was doing. And that, I laughed it off at the time, but that was probably the biggest thing that I had nightmares for ages after that. And everything that happened, if I had a car accident and the first thing that happened when I hit the tree was God's trying to kill me. And that really stuck with me, and it stuck. And my view of God after leaving that was God's just mad at me. God hates me.
Because your brother also said the same thing. He felt, not that he was threatening you or anything, but he just was so sad, wasn't he? Tell us a little bit about this.
He was distraught. Your brother, who's very unemotional. Yeah. So I packed my stuff and I went to all of my siblings' houses. I went to Tabitha's house first and Buddy, and Buddy was very cold and distant towards me.
Mm.
But Tab was bawling her eyes out and she's like, oh my goodness, what are you doing? Don't run away from God. But I just, I said goodbye to them and I left there. And then I went to Lydia's house, and she was like a mother to me growing up. She was she was awesome. She was everything to me. And I went to her house to say goodbye to her and my little nephew Jaden, and it was I was never gonna see them again. I knew that the decision I was making was me never seeing my family again. So it was so hard. She was the hardest to say goodbye to. And, my little nephew as well. I remember seeing him he was in the bathtub and I'm like, I'm going to Victoria. And he was like, why are you going? When are you coming back? And, my sister's there oh, she's not coming back. It was just horrible, but she didn't, threaten me or anything. She was just really sad.
Yeah.
And then I went to my brother's house and I just hugged his wife for about 10 minutes and she didn't say anything. She was just crying and she was one of my best friends. And I just kept on saying, I have to. And that's the only thing I let myself feel like I was really upset, but I just kept on saying, I have to do this.
Yeah.
And then I went to hug my brother, and he's like, I'm not hugging you.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you leaving? You're such an idiot. Like, that's how he was very cold.
Yeah.
And I hugged him. He didn't try to hug me or anything. And he's like, you're such an idiot. What are you doing? It's just, what are you even doing with your life, Mook? Like, you're just going to destroy your life. Very, very cold. And I'm like, well, I'm leaving, and I'm not going to see you for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't hug me, wouldn't do anything. So I left. I went out to the car. And he came out, like, he ran after me, and he's so hard, and he doesn't let himself feel much, but he ran out, and he was, you know, when people are, like, shaking, and they can't breathe because they're crying so much, that's what he was doing, and he's just like,
me cry now.
I know, I'm getting emotional. It was awful, and he's just like, he truly believed that me leaving meant me dying, like, I was going to die, and he's like, what am I going to tell, like, all your Papua New Guinean friends and your Papua New Guinean parents? And I'm like, tell them the truth, like, I'm leaving. And at the time I was saying, like, I'm not going to have anything to do with God. I'm like, tell them that I don't want God anymore. I'm sick of this crap. Like, I'm done with Christianity. Because you associate
those two so closely.
Yeah. Yep. And then he was like, you're going to die. Like, you're gonna die, Mook. Like, you, that's like, hectic, isn't it? And he genuinely believed, like, and he was talking about my funeral as if it was something that was gonna happen, like, really soon. And he's like, we're gonna have to bury you, Mook. Like, we're gonna, it was horrible.
And he genuinely, like I said, that was so such a deep sad grief for him.
And I just kept on, I said to him, I would actually rather die than stay here. So if I, it was again, so,
weighing up was so powerful.
It was to the point where, like, I would have rather died than stay in that cage. Because I couldn't, like, I can't stay in the cage. And it meant losing my entire family.
Mm.
And it was a really horrible cost, but it just, I couldn't stay there. I just couldn't do it. So I left. I just got in my car and I drove down to Victoria.
Wow.
And then I began the next part of my journey. Yeah.
The unpacking. The unpacking part.
The unpacking.
Yeah, and that's huge because, again, you know, when you think about people in this situation, there's sort of the hopelessness, the loss, the grief of loss, and then it goes into another phase where the healing begins, but it's a slow process, isn't it? You've been at this now, what, how long ago since you left?
I left in August 2019, so it's like a year and 2-3 months.
Okay, right. So still not that far down the track, and yet
no,
there's been some incredible growth. Like, even just to sort of fast forward it, we've only got a few more minutes to go, but just thinking in fast forward mode, and you were sharing me a bit the other day, you mentioned you've gone and got counselling, you've sort of done a lot of work on yourself. Yeah. You and I have talked at
length. Yeah, a lot.
You've talked with many, many people, haven't you, over this 1 year, and you've had some strange experiences.
Very strange experiences. I think the first, like, probably 4 to 6 months was surviving.
Yes, yeah, survive.
And I was traumatized, and I didn't see it so much at the time. Like, I was sort of like, nah, I'm fine, whatever. But now looking back, like, the damage that I did to my body just with stress,
yes.
And I wasn't sleeping, I wasn't eating, I was just, I put on a lot of weight, like, not even from eating, just from stress.
Yeah.
And I didn't, but I wasn't quite aware so much of that at all. I was in survival mode.
Yes.
I just needed to keep my head above water survive and make sure really that I didn't go home.
Yeah, that's right. So everything was about
staying away.
And you needed that anger at that time too. You needed to hold you because the pull back to family, and there was events where that happened where there was different calls back and different people trying to draw you back. There was
communication and, like, manipulation, but I know that they... My family loves me, and they just want me home because they love me. But, my mum would send me photos. My mum would send me these photos and, like, photos of me when I was little in PNG. And she's like, oh, Mookie, we miss you. Like, it was the manipulation at the start. It was sort of like, let's emotionally get her home.
That's right. So there was emotional manipulation. There was sort of a bit of blackmail from your dad at some points about trying to draw you back in or else.
Yeah. And my, this is gonna happen. With the missionary thing, threatened me with that one.
That's right, that he would be
and,
out.
Yeah, and that was really hard for me because, like...
So he did follow through.
He followed through. Like, my dad is not a missionary anymore. And I struggled with guilt.
Yeah.
a lot.
So he laid that on you first and said, you know, this is what it's going to cost. Yeah. You stay out there.
And, like, I'll give it to my dad. When he said it, he was like, I'm not guilt tripping you. Mm. I'm just saying this is going to have to happen. But, like, please don't feel like. He didn't want me to stay if I didn't want to. Yeah. And out of it all, like, my dad was the most gracious person, I guess. Mm. He's just stuck in the system.
Yes.
But he was like, I have to leave the mission field sort of thing. But please don't feel guilty for it because it's not your fault. But it is. But my dad wasn't, like, harsh in that way. Like, you've just ruined my whole life. He was just sort of like... It's going to happen. Inevitable. It's going to happen. And he did. He followed through with it.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the system requires, doesn't it? It's like a dogmatic adherence to the rules.
Yep.
Even to the point where you have to go against your own heart. You know, you were saying about just a few weeks back, your mum was on a call to you and she was like, I want to talk to you, but I can't tell, you know, my husband or your dad that I've talked to you or anybody else because I'll get in trouble, you know? And you're like... To go against your own heart for your daughter, like, this is a deep ingrained, isn't it, in the system? The system, like, these are good people. Your family are good people. The people are good people.
Yeah.
But there's something so deep that they'll go against their very, very heart.
Yeah.
Like, your mother, daughter, that's big.
I know. My mum has, like, she loves me so much. Yeah. She wants me in her life.
Of course she does.
And she, every time I call her, like, the first thing she says, she's like, well, just to clarify, you're calling me, I didn't call you.
That's right.
Like, because she'll get in trouble. Because if she, like, if people find out that she initiated contact with me, it's like she's going against, like, the contract or whatever. And she gets in trouble and then she's out. And she's not, like, I have no resentment towards my mum in that sense. Like, I would never expect her to go against the rules because she's older.
And there's a lot. There's
she's got grandkids and like four other kids. I'm only one kid out of four.
That's
and
right. She there's loves a lot to lose. Yeah, exactly.
And so I would never like expect anything more from her. But like it's horrible. Like every time I talk to her, it's sort of like you called me, I didn't call you, I didn't initiate the contact with you.
Clarify,
like, let's clarify this. And like I'm not going to tell anyone that I talked. I'm not going to tell anyone that like you know. And she's like, please also don't tell any of your friends that like you talk to me. And I'm like, Mum, I'm going to. Because I get excited when I talk to you. So I'm like, oh.
Yeah, I don't have to be secretive. I'm
an open book. I'm free. And it's the last maybe, I've been out for a year and a bit now, so it's probably been nearly 4 months now where I've started, like, the healing. So it was survival mode, and then I went through a bit of a weird situation where I sort of gave up again.
Mm.
And I nearly went home then. But then now I'm like... in the healing mode. I know that I'm not going back. They don't have a hold on me anymore.
The chain is almost like severed, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know? It's awesome. And it's starting to, like, my heart is being filled with forgiveness for these people now. And instead of being driven by the anger, which I needed at the time, now, like, God's helping me and he's put love in my heart. Like, he's put love in everyone's heart.
Yeah.
And it's sort of instead of being insanely angry at these people. It's sad because they're stuck where I was, sort of thing.
And you're sort of seeing now, by the sound of it, from a different perspective, you're sort of looking back and seeing that this system is the problem, isn't it? It's the system that's built in, that people fall into the system.
Yeah.
And that's
it's not the people's fault, it's the system's fault.
Good-hearted people with love beautiful for God people. And then become dogmatic about certain things and they have to live by the rules.
Yep.
I remember hearing recently, and over again, actually, I can't remember who it is, but God loves people more than the rules, you know, and it's like the opposite way in these systems.
Yeah.
The rules are more important than love.
Uh-huh.
You know, God loves the rules more than he loves the people, and therefore the rules become the structure of your whole life.
Yeah.
And you kind of get stuck there. You
really do. And it's been, like, now my view of God was always that, like, God does love the rules more than he loves me.
Yes.
And that's why I was so scared that he was actually going to kill me.
Absolutely.
But now I'm learning that God is so much more than their system and he's so much more than anything that I've ever thought he was. And, like, just everything that I have known about him, it's not who he is. So now it's sort of like going on into the next stage of, like, this process, which is healing and learning who God is. and breaking down the rules, because they're still very ingrained in me. Like, when I do certain things, I'm like, oh, no. What did I just do? That yes. It's sort of learning that no matter what I do, I'm okay with God. Whereas before, it's like, if you do this, you're on the out. But now it's learning to, like, reprogram my brain into being like, no matter what I do, God's love is far greater.
Absolutely.
And that's where I'm at the moment.
Yeah. And that's a huge step, isn't it? Because the deprogramming, the deconstructing of the, you know, the story that's been told you all your life is a long process. And, I think looking back, just, you know, a year is a long time, but it's also not that long. You've come a long, long way to be able to look back with sort of perspective, if you like.
Yeah.
Because I think the anger clouds the perspective for a while, like you said. Once that drifts away, which it does for all of us, I think we deal with it, we get to see again, you know, and seeing people as they really are, like heart to heart, you know what I mean, you're freer, you know,
because that anger so free.
Kind of holds us a bit. But, you know, I think that trying not to live out of that script that they put out for you is such a challenging thing. And I like to talk about that maybe at a different point in time, but to think about the agreements and the script that people speak over us, and we feel like, in a way, we take that on as our identity, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, I'm this, I'm that, I'm no good, I'm a whore, I'm dirty, I'm, you know, shameful, guilty, you know, all this sort of stuff. And we do take it on so much, and we kind of almost walk out expecting that that's who we are now. And this is, I think, where the power is so bad in these groups.
Yeah.
Because they have power to then speak into us lies, basically. Yeah. And we take them on as truth.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh, I must be a drunkard if I've had two lots of drinks. Really?
Yeah.
Was that ever what that was meant to say?
No.
Even quite. You know what I mean? But
that
power that we give that over.
Yeah.
And I think that symbolism of that signing of that bit of paper really is very, it's almost like you'll come into the door of that glass cage and go, I'm going to go in.
Yeah.
I'm happy to go in. Matter of fact, I'm going to sign over and give you everything at the door, leave it all outside and come in.
Yeah. And they lock the door behind you and you're not allowed out. You're not allowed out.
And you don't realise what you've done at the time. You're sort of like,
you really don't.
I'm coming in.
You blindly follow because it looks good.
It does.
And it's exciting and whatever, but
it has great promise at the time, but cannot deliver.
And if you can function in that, that's great, because you have a community and a family forever.
Yes,
you'll be happy forever, because their little system is great if you do what they want.
As long as you totally.
But I can't follow their rule book. I'm too different.
No, that most people can't talk, and I think that's the reality. Yeah. Eventually, everyone out of disciples.
They realise.
Oh, we've always got people here. There's this, but it's just a sort of revolving door scenario.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
But thanks for sharing all that, Morgan. I appreciate your honesty. And for anyone who's listening to this, I think it's a really good open door into what these things are like. Whether you've been part of it or you know someone who is, it's good to share it with them so that they can see, you know, and get an idea of just how deep this stuff is entrenched and the effect that it has. Like, looking in from the outside, I think, just leave here, whatever, it's no big deal. Mm. You're not chained up, but the chains are real, the glass is real. Yeah, everything's very real.
And hearing, I think it's important to hear from other people too, because if I didn't have you and Auntie Judy, who had been in the same system that I was in, and you guys aren't like drug addict alcoholics, like you guys love God now, and you're out of the church, and seeing people that weren't like completely just had ruined their lives and still love God after coming out of the system. That's sort of what's driven me.
It's possible.
Yeah, it's possible, because there's
another world.
Yeah, there's a grey area.
Yeah.
There's grey. There's not black and white anymore. And like, I think that's why this podcast is awesome, because other people need to know that there's grey areas. It's not all black and white. You're not in and you're not out. Might be in and out of the system, but you're not in God or out of God. You're like, we're all, you know, we're
nothing
all in.
Nothing can separate us from the life.
No, nothing.
Nothing. Death nor life.
Nothing.
Certainly no little church group or a couple of drinks on a Saturday night. Seriously, come on.
There's
nothing
so,
can separate.
Yeah,
God is
so much,
much
bigger.
Bigger.
It's awesome. It's exciting.
It is.
So there's hope.
There's hope.
There's
exactly.
hope.
I think we could leave it on that one. Look, that's beautiful to think about that. There is great hope. So we'll catch up another time and go for another session and go into that a little further. But thanks for your time. That's awesome.